Professional wrestling is the one true sport. Other sports have their share of intense, dramatic moments, but nothing can compare with professional wrestling. Welcome to Wrestling History X, where three friends come together to talk about the stories behind the matches. I'm Matt.
I'm Fight.
And I'm Glory.
That's because these guys are fighting.
For glory.
For glory. The t-shirt was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, New Japan designs are pretty solid as far as tours and tournaments and shows go.
Welcome to episode 262, G1 Climax 19. 97.
You know this is where we love to be.
That's right.
No bullshit. No extended in-ring promos. They're just fighting for glory.
And trophies.
Large checks from women in one pieces.
Yeah.
Cool guy stuff.
So this is the seventh rendition of the G1 Climax, produced by New Japan Pro Wrestling. It would take place between August 1st to August 3rd, 1997.
It's a quick one.
From the Rigoku Gogugikon in Tokyo, Japan, with an attendance of 11,500 all three nights.
Come on. Not to pull the curtain back, single elimination tournament, why would you not want to go to all three? Mm-hmm. And it's a hot product at the moment, so pretty sick to draw 33,000 people in three nights. Fucking cool.
Yeah.
And Japanese crowd, people say they're quiet. I disagree completely. They are into it.
They know what they want. They know what they like.
But we are in Tokyo, Japan.
Yeah.
So Shane, did you do what you do?
Sure looks like it.
Hey. Yes, we are in Tokyo, and yeah, I did what I do, but I didn't have to do too much because typically with Tokyo, I just try and find some sort of Japanese food to bring our way, and today was no different. I have a fairly new Japanese restaurant, a sushi bar that opened up across the street from the restaurant that I manage here in Oklahoma City called Awaji Izakaya. So I scrolled through their menu. I'd never been there before and figured I'd see what the hell they have. Because typically I let places be open for, you know, a good month or 6 weeks or so before I officially dive in. That way they can work out all their kinks and stuff. And super friendly people when I walked in there. I went for a little variety of stuff. Of course I had to get some of the gyoza.
I mean, I feel like I can eat gyoza for every meal.
Pork dumplings, made fresh daily in-house, pan-seared or steamed, served with a thickened ponzu sauce. I've got a variety of this before. This is a bloody hamachi sashimi. It is yellowtail, blood orange, a yuzu ponzu, black tobiko caviar, and orange zest.
It's delicious. It's so good.
And it's shipped really, really cool as far as taking it to go. They put it in your typical to-go box, but then in the bag they had a little bag of ice that sat on top of it that keeps it extra cold and helps keep it in place so it doesn't shift around.
Wow. Like,
that's just genius.
Yeah.
I also went for a couple different rolls. We have one that is called the Okie Dokie. It's because, you know, this show has some WCW mixed in with it, so I figured I'd get a little bit of Southern in. Crispy chicken, bacon, cream cheese, avocado, nori, sesame, crab stick, eel sauce, and spicy miso sauce.
Which was very delicious.
The other one is a duo Osaka-style press sushi. It has... it's a spicy yellowtail, avocado, sushi rice, tuna press sushi with spicy mayo and eel sauce. It's stacked like a sandwich almost, with the crust cut off. You know, you
that's
got your
literally what it looks like.
Your rice for the bread. You have your avocado and stuff inside between the rice, and then the tuna pressed on top, a little bit of the spicy mayo or whatever it is on top. It all looks really good. So
it's all very
good. I don't know where to start. My only critique is I got no to-go soy sauce or to-go chopsticks, but
I have soy sauce.
I ain't mad about it.
Chopsticks, but it's okay.
All right, let's do this yellowtail.
This is real good.
I have not had a bite that I did not like yet.
No, I have some favorites, but by no means was any of it bad. This ponzu sauce goes off.
Wow, that fish it's with super the thick. Blood oranges. Awesome. Really good. I mean, I'm used to having it with lemon and jalapeno and stuff, but that orange.
Yeah, it's like a
fucking great
fresh fishy salad, citrusy fish salad. It's so good. But that thickened ponzu sauce, pretty awesome.
Yeah, I do the gozo without ponzu sauce the first time, and it's very flavorful without it.
Some of the better gyoza I've had.
That ponzu sauce is very delightful as well.
All right, let's try this little okie dokie. See what this chicken cream cheese bacon roll is all about.
It's good, but it's at the bottom of my list if I were to make one.
It's the what?
It's the bottom of my list of these items here. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of anti-cream cheese in my sushi. And I love cream cheese.
Let's try this pressed one.
So I love cream cheese in my sushi, so
yeah.
It's pretty high on mine.
Yeah.
And I like sushi. Okay. I am a fan of that one.
Yeah, that's the best of the two rolls is that, in my opinion, that guy. But this guy is a star.
Yeah,
the, like, I gotta the blood tail, orange. Yeah,
the stacked or the pressed.
Yeah, the gyoza is some of the better gyoza I've had, and I'm putting it at number three. But I just have a slight bias with the cream cheese. By no means was it bad, but it doesn't taste like sushi.
I think that one would be better, just a little warmer.
Yeah, but yeah, this was great. I'll have to. Is it in Oklahoma City?
Yes, okay. It's 122nd Rockwell.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll have to keep an eye on that one, because a good sushi place.
Shane's found him a new lunch spot for work.
No, it's only dinner. They're only open for dinner, 4 o'clock.
That means you know they do it right.
Yeah, that's why when I introduced myself when I went over there, like, I've been wanting to come over here for a while, but typically when I'm out, it's 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night, and I don't even want to stop anywhere. I just want to get home. So
true.
Yeah, no, that was great. We've had some mediocre or even terrible Japanese outings.
Yes.
But this was maybe one of the best.
And you know what? It's because we're recording on a Monday.
It's easy. Yeah, Sunday's not a good day to go eat anywhere.
Bring kayfabe there. But
yeah, Sundays aren't good days to find food in Oklahoma City.
Especially Asian food, because even though that's a day where a lot of people are out and about, that's a day where a lot of places decide they want to be closed.
Also, like, sushi is kind of... There's affordable sushi, and there's super high-end sushi, but, like, it's not a Sunday food. It's a Friday food, a Saturday food, but, like, who's going and getting fancy sushi on a Sunday? In Oklahoma. Other states may be different, but in Oklahoma, people don't really do a lot on Sunday.
See, this is why we need to record in Tulsa for one episode, because they do an authentic Japanese breakfast at a certain restaurant up there.
Oh, yeah.
We'll have to just do, like, a live remote.
Yeah, the soft
sitting around the table.
Yeah, the eggs mixed into the hot rice. I've never done that.
Mm-hmm. Well, something that would happen, a couple movies would actually come out right around the same time as the G1 Climax. Air Force One and Good Burger.
Man, huge fan of these movies as a kid.
I've seen each of those at least once.
I think I own a copy of Good Burger and watched the crap out of it. I have a specific memory of my grandma was into, she liked movies, and we rented Air Force One and watched it, and we were both like, that was great, that was so fun, and then me telling, like, my dad, be like, oh, you gotta see this, this is great, and we sat down and watched it, but there was an issue showing any movie with an airplane to my dad, because he worked on airplanes, so him, like, I think there was some other family friends over when I was like, oh, you guys got to see this, and they were just tearing all of the airplane stuff apart, and I was like, fuck, it's like, yeah, it's like, I'm not having fun. They were having fun, like, shitting on all of the, like, airplane technical stuff, but at me, at like, as, like, a 9-year-old kid or whatever, I just saw a really fun Harrison Ford, like, airplane thriller. And I don't know how it holds up, because I haven't seen it probably since I was 9 or 10.
And say, I haven't watched it in... But it came out in 97, so... It's been a good 25 years, probably, since I saw it last.
I've definitely seen Good Burger way more.
I was working at Blockbuster when it came out, so I have a vivid memory of the image of Harrison Ford on the preview for it, where he's, like, holding his wife.
Oh, okay.
Trying to pull her, protect her, or something like that. I don't know. There's, like, no words. It's just music that's being played on it, but there's just this image of him with the diva fan blowing his hair and, you know, trying to look all tough and brooding.
Yeah, I wonder if this is the beginning of Harrison Ford being like, yeah, I'm gonna finally make a movie. I'm doing it on, like, one set. We're doing as little as possible here.
This is Harrison Ford being Sean Connery.
Yeah, this is probably, I guess, that's not true because there's Indiana Jones movies and stuff like that. But I feel like after this, he works a lot less. And then the Zemeckis movie.
What Lies Beneath?
Throwback. What Lies Beneath is a little after this.
He wasn't that.
Yeah, it's him and Michelle Pfeiffer. Yeah, they're like the only people in the movie.
Before, when you were saying What Lies Beneath, what happened or what popped in my head was What Dreams May Come.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why when you were saying it, I was like, wait, he's not in that. And yeah. Then and all of a sudden, I just had the Blockbuster revelation and could see the cover box. Yeah.
I was a good age for Good Burger, and I was a huge Nickelodeon kid. So, I watched a lot of all of that. I know Kenan and Kel, Good Burger, was funny. An introduction for me to George Clinton, who I later, as a budding music fan, became a huge fan of...
Emphasis on the bud.
George Clinton and his various projects. I remember, I believe Sinbad is the driver of the car they hit in the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's a good time, but it's for children, and I think that...
Other than what... Going back to Harrison Ford real fast.
Yeah, go ahead.
Other than What Lies Beneath, Air Force One's his last good movie.
I believe you.
And now he's got that Bill Lawrence show. That was it called?
He has a TV show?
Apple TV.
Why would he do that?
Because Bill Lawrence gave him a bunch of money. Greatness.
And I don't know who Bill
if Meryl Streep can do it for HBO and ABC and Nicole Kidman can do it, then why not have Harrison Ford?
I didn't know Meryl Streep was doing television.
Yes, she did.
But it's one of the things, like, I feel like Harrison Ford has enough money and he's such a, you know, I love how curmudgeonly he is. I think it's funny and awesome. And it's one of those things, there's that interview where someone asks him, like, well, you know, the Greedo shot first thing or whatever. I can't remember exactly what he says, but he basically just tells him to fuck off. He's just like, he's like, I don't care. And I think that is so cool and funny. I love it when a Star Wars actor is a little bit angry about the fact that nobody will shut up about Star Wars. And him and Boyega are kings for it. And I like Star Wars. I'm not, it's just funny. It's like, oh, Star Wars actors aren't like Star Trek actors, where once you're in Star Trek, you are a Star Trek guy that goes to conventions and stuff like that. Star Wars actors, it's like, you know, it either your career goes
nowhere or everywhere.
Or nowhere or everywhere, exactly, like with Harrison Ford. And then on the other side of that, you have, you know,
Mark Hamill.
It's like, yeah, he did great voice work, but he was never a great actor and he was never in any great films outside of Star Wars.
Guyver is mediocre.
I love Guyver, but I love it because of what it is, and I'm a fan of, like, the comic and the B movie of it all.
Guyver.
It's like a live action anime adaptation from the
80s. Basically, gets like an alien suit.
Yeah.
And becomes a superhero. Yeah.
And the cartoon is hyper violent. And the movie gets a little bit there. It has a bunch of weird special effects. It's not a good movie, but it's a good, like, B movie.
Hmm.
Yeah. Speaking of good B movies, Good Burger.
Yeah.
It's just a fun time.
It is, for
the kids.
I didn't watch it until, like, 5 or 6 years ago for the first time.
How many times?
It was great stuff.
I've seen Good Burger probably, like, 20, 30 times.
I still quote, "Welcome to Good Burger."
Yeah, I'm with Good Burger, yeah.
I included it in a lip sync throwdown 1 year.
And their TV show, like the Keenan and Kel show, Who Loves Orange Soda? Kel Loves Orange Soda? There's one that me and my friends quote all the time from an episode of Keenan and Kel where there's like a courtroom scene or something like that, but it's like, who put the screw in the tuna? And because, yeah, there was a screw in the tuna and somebody bit on it, but we say it all the time. Don't really know why. Can't even picture the scene in my head at this point, but it's lived outside of that.
So with the whole Good Burger movie,
uh-huh.
Have you watched this new documentary, Quiet on the Set?
I've heard a lot about it, but I haven't watched it. I mean, the thing
doesn't
about...
Doesn't surprise anyone.
No. The thing that I find weird is that everybody, creepy as he may be, Dan Schneider comes out looking a little bit better because there's a guy that like legitimately was sexually assaulting, is a weak way to put it, Drake Bell, whereas Dan Schneider
asked for massages.
Did not actually, yeah, it's like, yeah, he was creepy, but he didn't... Yeah, he didn't do the thing I'm not going to say right now.
What's crazier for me, I mean, the whole thing is crazy, but as somebody growing up watching Head of the Class, the fact that the fat nerdy guy from Head of the Class ended up becoming this kids show phenomenon creator.
Did you guys actually watch any of it, or have you just seen clips?
I've watched it.
Okay. Does Neil Brennan show up at all?
Remind me who Neil Brennan is.
Neil Brennan was very young when he started writing for All That, and then he went on to be Chappelle's writing partner, and like he was the other guy was responsible for Chappelle's show. He like wrote and directed a lot of it and was like the writing partner, but I was curious if he was actually in the documentary. He had a podcast that I used to listen to, but he stopped it and started a different one.
Let's see what his face looks like. I don't recognize him from the show,
but yeah, he also wrote Half-Baked as well, but like him and Dave Chappelle were like writing partners for the majority of the best Dave Chappelle stuff outside of Dave Chappelle's stand-up. He didn't help with that, but he helped with the Chappelle show, and he wrote on All That when he was like 20 or something.
Yeah, they did. Like the first episode was kind of the starting shows, you know, All That with the original cast that they had on there. And then the next episode, it was like they jumped into some Amanda Bynes stuff because...
She was a breakout star of all that.
She was the new queen of All That. And then the Amanda show.
And then into like and then Drake they had and the Josh Drake episode. Carly.
Yeah. I've seen 3 episodes. I don't know. I heard there was another one, but...
Yeah.
When I was looking it up, they had like 4 episodes listed, but one of them was a 2-part episode that they had split into 2 episodes. Like, so yeah.
These television documentaries, I know this is like serious subjects and most of them are, but they do this thing where they don't get to the point and they sometimes undercut a lot of things, or it feels exploitative because they like, you know, are just like teasing you with like information that's upsetting. Or like, you know, stuff that actually happened, where it's like, all right, well, yeah, this is still television. You're still pulling tricks. But yeah, if you watched All That, and not the TV show, but this documentary, you might need to watch Good Burger. Or maybe yes. Air Force One to clean the palate.
Exactly. Let's talk G1 to clean our palate. So this version, like Michael said earlier, was a 14-man single elimination tournament. And we have all of the matches.
Wild.
Because we found a 2-part video that can be found on archive.org. So you don't have to sell the high C's for this one.
Yeah, it might be on YouTube too, but archive.org, an underrated resource for just about anything.
Also... Last time we saw most of these guys was at Wrestling World 97, episode 235. Of course, if it's different, I'll say so. But the video package starts with pictures and highlights of all of our competitors. We get a title and logo coming on the screen, followed by footage from outside of the arena where fans wait to get in.
I mean, we all know that WWF makes great packages and... for matches and whatnot, and like typically good intros and stuff like that. Japan's been doing it so well for so long. This really does get you hyped up.
We then see the wrestlers training inside before the show, before seeing the full house and the bracket of the tournament. which is in Japanese, so we don't know exactly what the bracket is.
But we're about to go through it.
That's right. As we get to our first match, Lord Steven Regal versus Satoshi Kojima in a first round battle.
Koji looking good as always.
Nice to see old Steven down there.
Yeah, but I mean, Kojima, of the older, you know, we call them New Japan dads at this point, he still might have, like, the best physique that's, like, the most similar to him at his prime.
Yeah.
Like, he's still just got that V-brolic chest. He's just an upside-down triangle of a man.
You're talking today?
Yeah, today. Hmm. Koji still is, has, his pecs are even bigger today, and it's not because he's fat.
So the match gets going, and it's back and forth with arm work until an athletic reversal by Regal takes it to the mat, grabbing a tiger hold, only for Satoshi to reverse it into one of his own. Lord Steven escapes and begins to fire up with European uppercuts, followed by taking it back to the mat with more holds, trying to get a pin out of it with a knuckle lock. When Kojima is able to make it back to his feet to reverse into a backdrop suplex and some mat holds of his own. Regal then counters to take the back, raking the face with his forearms before kneeing him in the face and stomping on the back of the head.
Dirty boy. Hey.
Lord Steven with a running back elbow and left hands, but he then charges into a big boot, allowing Satoshi to charge out with a clothesline and call for the end. Kojima nails a riding bomb, which is a sit-out spine buster.
It looks cool.
For a two count. Heads up top for a flying elbow drop for a near fall, then delivers several lariats that finally knock Regal over for another two count. Satoshi goes back up to the top, but Lord Steven meets him there with a left hand and a headbutt, before bringing him down with a double underhook superplex for multiple near falls.
I mean, the timing of the spots in this match is so good. I mean, of course, they got 11,000 people three nights in a row, but the crowd is so into it that when Steven starts to fire back after taking some large moves, it just really brings you there.
Lord Steven then hits a T-bone suplex for a two count, applies the Regal stretch, only for Kojima to make the ropes to break the hold.
And my God, did he dump him on his head.
Lord Steven grabs a waist lock, but Satoshi breaks it and goes for a clothesline, only for Regal to duck and grab the waist lock again. So Kojima escapes with a cutter for the pin and the win. Post-match, and this is for basically every match, the wrestlers are interviewed as they head back to the locker room, but it's all in Japanese, so no clue what they say.
Most of the English guys don't say much.
Except for when the English guys just yell at the cameraman to get out of their way.
Yeah, yeah, they don't have any, like, yeah, it's not like today's New Japan where you might get a really good promo from a Jay White or a Zack Sabre Jr. or something. That doesn't happen here.
No. So we go to our second match, Hiroshi Tenzan versus Tadao Yoshida in a first round battle.
And we will see a lot of New Japan NWO on this show.
Yes.
Yes.
Tenzan being part of the NWO. So, you know, that's kind of the story here, is that there's NWO guys and there's New Japan guys and there's some WCW guys.
And see, I knew they had NWO there, but I'd never watched any of it until we've been doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, the most disappointing thing for me
is it
seeing NWO
infiltrate.
Yeah. Like, damn it. I wanted, yeah.
I will say.
But I wanted to see what they were going to do as opposed to how
the
WCW did theirs.
I mean, this is obviously less offensive. It's not, yeah, not as weaselly. I'll say that. But we'll talk about it as we go through.
So last time we saw Tadao was at Collision in Korea, episode 161.
I just like the name. Tadao.
Yeah, I don't know if it's Tadao or Tadeo.
Ah, Tadeo Takamine.
Tadeo.
Space Camp.
Okay. But Tadao is huge, and he kind of looks like Hanare. He reminds me of a current New Japan wrestler in the face, but he's so damn big. It's like, I feel like I should have remembered this guy. But I
believe he's a former sumo wrestler.
That makes sense, because we'll get to some spots that, you know, feed into that.
So they keep backing each other up into corners to begin, when Yoshida would shove Tenzan, angering the bull. So they begin trading chops and shoulder blocks, with neither man giving an inch, until Tadao lifts Hiroyoshi up for a choke slam, forcing him to the floor to regroup. Back in the ring, Yoshida goes right back on the attack with a double choke lift and an elbow drop for a two count. The two then trade chin and arm locks before Tenzan nails several chops and headbutts, only for Tadao to respond with sumo-style slaps and a big boot.
And I will say, for a former sumo, he's very tall, but he is not fat. He does not look like Yokozuna. He has more in common with like a Andre the Giant physique.
Yoshida continues with a scoop slam and an elbow drop, only for Hiroyoshi to avoid and start choking Tadao, followed by Mongolian chops and attempting a suplex. But Yoshida counters into one of his own.
As much as I kind of hate the Mongolian chop, they at least sell it and make it look better here in 97. Because today, one just looks like you're like telling your drunk friend to chill out and he just kind of slapped you on the shoulders or whatever. But they're at least putting it in for not one of the best looking wrestling maneuvers.
The two men trade strikes again, with Tadao gaining the advantage and applying an ab stretch, with Tenzan only escaping because he falls to the mat. Hiroyoshi goes back to the Mongolian chops until Yoshida blocks and counters with more sumo slaps. But after a reversed whip, Tenzan charges into a big boot, allowing Tadao to nail an avalanche attack in the corner. Yoshida hits a double underhook suplex for a two count, a lariat for a near fall, but then telegraphs his move, allowing Hiroyoshi to set up for a powerbomb, only for Tadao to counter into a back body drop. And Yoshida tries for another avalanche attack, but Tenzan avoids and delivers a bridging German for a two count, followed by going for a top rope Mongolian chop, only for Tadao to get a boot up to the chin. And Yoshida continues with a Samoan drop, a double underhook sit-out powerbomb for the pin, and no, Hiroyoshi kicks out. Tadao heads up top, only for Tenzan to meet him there, bringing him down with a superplex, before also nailing a diving headbutt for the pin, and no, Yoshida kicks out. Hiroyoshi then hits a top rope moonsault.
My God.
For the pin, and the win.
I mean, Tenzan moonsault, surprising, but it makes so much sense, because I know from the pop from the crowd that, like, a diving headbutt from him is typically what it takes to put somebody away, but he needs to do the moonsault, and it's all there in context clues, blatantly, and of course he has to do that, because the guy he's fighting is giant, and he doesn't look weak throughout the match either. It's really well put together, and Yasuda is a good big man worker, and I know we've seen him before, but he didn't stick in my mind. But it's, you know, probably been 6 months to a year as far as,
been
you know,
a couple years since we've seen him.
Okay, a couple of years as far as the timeline goes. And my God, I mean, this guy's a believable killer.
So we go to our third match: Scott Norton versus Junji Hirata in a first round battle.
Scott Norton looking big as ever. What a monster.
And I think I missed this the last time we saw Junji, but he is the former Super Strong Machine. But he unmasked in late 1994.
Kind of like we'll see a future warrior that we all already know the name of, because, well, Power, yeah, Power Warrior. Future Power. We'll see Power Warrior in the future. But we all know his name because he still used it at the same time.
Yeah. So Norton with chops right away that knock Hirata down, followed by a shoulder block and headbutts. Scott with more chops and knees in a corner before Junji avoids a charge, allowing him to hip toss and lariat Norton down to the mat. but Scott responds with a big boot and clotheslines of his own to regain control. Norton then goes into a nerve hold.
Yeah, I always want to say trap hold. The crowd is the least hot that it's been so far this evening.
Trying to wear down his opponent, followed by a neck breaker for a two count. But Scott telegraphs a back body drop, allowing Hirata to kick him away, only for Norton to fire right back with a shoulder block and stomps that sends Juji out to the floor. And Scott follows out to continue the punishment, but has his whip reversed, sending Norton into a guardrail and a ring post.
Posted.
Before returning to the ring, where Hirata works the arm with different holds, including a cross arm breaker. Juji delivers a hammerlock suplex for a two count.
Hell yeah. That gets a pop.
Before nailing an arm breaker DDT and heading up top for a diving headbutt that gets a near fall. Hirata hits the ropes for several running forearms until Scott catches and drops him with a power slam for a two count. Norton then hits multiple avalanche attacks in a corner, followed by a power bomb for the pin
and the win. This was fine. The thing here that you can take away is that Juji Hirata is not a star. I'm not going to call him a bad wrestler because I didn't see anything horrific here, but he's not over because they put Scott Norton over him, and Scott Norton is an American wrestler. He's done a lot of work in New Japan, but Scott Norton is a foreign heel.
And he's part of the NWO.
And he's part of the NWO. And he doesn't have the charisma of a Tenzan or a Chono, or definitely not a great Muda.
Or a Steven Regal.
Also true.
So we go to our fourth match, Michi Yoshiohara versus Masahiro Chono with Hiro Saito and Hiroyoshi Tenzan in a first round battle. And the ladies love Masahiro as he comes out to the ring.
I mean,
there was that lady that just like runs out and is like, oh my God!
I do love that Masahiro Chono is up on the like Matrix glasses 2 years ahead of time.
Yep.
That's pretty fun. And also fun to see him in his, like, cyberpunk gear. And then Ohara just wearing, like, traditional Japanese garb with, like, the big beads and the samurai hat and the robe. He's got a great look.
So our competitors go back and forth with holds until Chono escapes a knuckle lock with a headbutt to the gut and a rake to the eyes.
Nasty.
Only for Hara to respond with a chop block that sends Masahiro out to regroup.
I love that. It's like, oh, I'm going to do some cheating. And it's like, well, I'm 4 feet wide and strong as hell, so I'm just going to backhand you to the ground.
Yeah, he's fighting the guy that's... Look, I don't remember if he's the one who fought...
Yes, Hakushi. He is. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, it's the guy that...
Big Trouble, Little China...
Yeah. Dude. He looks similar to Hakushi, except for he is paler skin tone, a little bit shorter, yeah. And a little bit wider. Like, he's... Not wide and fat, just like he's a bruiser.
And he doesn't have the little writings.
No, that would be gimmick infringement. You could kill a man for that.
Back in the ring, a chop fest breaks out with Chono winning, but Michiyoshi comes right back with headbutts and yanking on the nose before hitting a back body drop and multiple running elbow drops.
Got your nose.
I know. I wonder if that's like some kind of like cultural disrespect we don't know about.
It hurts.
I know, of course it hurts. But, you know, I'm making a joke, man.
Ohara goes for the legs, only for Masahiro to make it to the ropes immediately. But Michiyoshi doesn't release right away.
Why would he?
Ohara then charges into a high knee, which knocks him down, allowing Chono to again regroup on the outside.
These NWO boys always pulling the powder.
Back inside, they go to the mat with some holds until Michiyoshi elbow drops the leg several times, which brings the rest of the NWO Japan group up to the apron. And Ohara continues working the leg with kicks and holds until Masahiro is able to crawl to the ropes to break the hold.
Break his knee.
Michiyoshi drags Chono back to the middle of the ring to again apply a leg lock, only for Masahiro to cradle him up for a two count. Ohara is able to stay on the attack with kicks and a jumping clothesline for a near fall. Chono then goes low as Michiyoshi picks him up, allowing Masahiro to go on the offensive with right hands, tossing him out to the floor, where Chono runs him into a guardrail before rolling Ohara back in. And Masahiro stomping away, followed by a body slam and heading up top for a flying clothesline, before nailing a pile driver and locking on the STF, forcing Mitsuyoshi to crawl his way to the ropes.
Yeah.
And Chono goes for a suplex, only for Ohara to reverse it into one of his own, followed by heading up top, where Masahiro meets him to deliver a superplex. Mitsuyoshi then makes it to his feet first, and hits another jumping clothesline for a near fall, followed by a choke slam for a two count. And Ohara tries for another, but Chono elbows his way free, allowing him to lock on a sleeper. Only for Mitsuyoshi to mule kick down low and deliver a powerbomb for a near fall.
Ball shot redemption.
Ohara then applies a scorpion deathlock, but instead of turning it over, he just falls backwards, putting Masahiro in pain and making him crawl his way to the ropes.
Masahiro just sells agony really well here. It's pretty great.
Did he already have the little walking boot cast?
No, he did not
yet?
Have it.
Okay.
No, this is the setup, brother.
Is that where it came from? Got it.
Yep, that's a common thing in Japanese tournaments is a early injury, whether it be real or kayfabe, that gets exploited and focused on throughout the tournament. It's wrestling, baby.
Smart.
Mitsuyoshi goes for another jumping clothesline, but Chono catches him with a high knee, leading to a chop battle.
No.
Only for Masahiro to nail another high knee and a pedigree before transitioning into an inverted guillotine chokehold for the submission and the win.
It broke my heart a little bit. I mean, I know Chono's way over, but Masahiro's good too. Sometimes, maybe I like Chono a lot, but maybe it's all the NWO that's been happening that I'm just like, ah.
Yep.
Plus, you know, as much as I liked Tadao, I was pretty stoked about Tenzan as well.
So we go to our fifth match, Manabu Nakanishi versus the Great Muda with Hiro Saito and Hiroyoshi Tenzan in a first round battle. And Muda goes right after the arm, only for Nakanishi to make the ropes and ask for a test of strength. But Great Muda just waves him off.
That's my dude.
Manabu's then taken to the mat with a headlock, but he powers his way out, only for Muda to hit a spin kick and toss Nakanishi out to the floor.
That snapmare might have been like the lowest and quickest one I've ever seen. It's like they just like stayed in the same place frozen and just brought him right down. It was wild.
Great Muda follows out, only for Manabu to immediately jump back in the ring. So Muda takes a walk into the crowd to regroup, before also going underneath the ring, coming out on the opposite side, just for shits and giggles.
Maybe he's loading up the mist.
Back inside, Nakanishi with kicks, chops, and a double choke lift, only for Great Muda to counter into an armbar, forcing Manabu to the ropes. And Muda again tosses Nakanishi out, following out and scaring a fan at ringside, before taking Manabu down to the aisle to ram him into the side of the bleachers. And they make their way back in, where Great Muda nails a flash elbow, kicks and chops, only to get caught with a backdrop suplex.
Nice.
And a swinging chokehold from Nakanishi, followed by a leaping leg drop. And Manabu tries to lift Muda up onto his shoulders, but he's blocked, allowing Great Muda to get back on the attack with turnbuckle smashes, a handspring back elbow, and a bulldog, before heading up top, only for Nakanishi to meet him there for a super backdrop suplex.
I love that throughout this whole match, Muda is teasing the mist. So he'll like put his fingers into his throat under his chin like at multiple times throughout this match to throw you off from when you assume it will inevitably happen. And it's a good and compelling way to use the gimmick.
Yep.
Instead of just being like, oh, he did it. He put his fingers in his throat and then he did it. And it's like, well, why would you, you know?
Do you feel lucky?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, wrestling is about manipulating the crowd for the biggest reaction. And that's what always should be first thing in your mind. And he's doing it here.
Manabu with a lariat and a bridging German for a two count. He starts running the ropes when Muto catches him for a hot shot across the top rope.
No.
And Nakanishi rolls out with Great Muto right behind him to grab the ring bell, smashing it over the head of Manabu, followed by running him into a guardrail.
That damn Muto.
Muto then grabs a screwdriver from under the ring.
Oh my god.
Stabbing at Nakanishi on the forehead before rolling him back in, with Great Muto heading up top for a single sledge. But Manabu catches and drops him with a belly-to-belly suplex.
And big ups to Muto for using the gimmick well, because if you pay enough attention, he like turns the screwdriver around, but it looks close and it looks good, and the way that he moves his arm and his body, it looks like he's stabbing him in the head with a screwdriver. But, you know, if you weren't looking for it, it looks meaner than most gimmick choices that we see.
Nakanishi nails another belly-to-belly, lifts him up for a torture rack, when Tenzan would jump on the apron to distract the ref, allowing Muto to again stab at the forehead with the screwdriver.
Ah, and boy, does it look good.
Great Muto would then set Manabu on the turnbuckles, spit the green mist at him, followed by a Frankensteiner for the pin. And the win.
Great character work by Muto, and a valiant effort by one Manabu Nakanishi. Has Manabu retired yet?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe so.
Yeah. It was pretty recently, but I feel like, is he the least decorated of these guys that are like, because like Tenzan, Kojima, like Nakanishi, I feel like Nakanishi... I doubt he was ever champion. You don't have to look it up. I'm just thinking in my head about where his career took him, and I feel like he may have been a dominant tag man at some point.
So we go to our sixth match, Kazuya Yamazaki versus Shinya Hashimoto.
Yeah.
In a first round battle.
And is Shinya the champion at the time?
He is the champion this time.
He does not come out with the belt.
No.
Which I think makes sense because this is a tournament,
mm-hmm.
but it felt a little bit weird because we wouldn't really see that in American wrestling. Like, the champion's out, he always has the belt, but this is the G1. So it's like, this isn't about him being the champion. This is about, like, who is the best in these couple of days
mm-hmm.
that this show's happening.
Yeah, because the winner, I mean, spoiler alert, the winner does get a match for the title, but it wasn't, like, a guaranteed thing back then.
Yeah, it was just kind of like, who's the guy that we're going to get behind and let the crowd know that he means something.
Yeah. So Yamazaki keeps his distance to start, but the two finally start kicking away at each other, followed by overhead chops from Shinya. More traded strikes until they end up in the ropes, but Hashimoto catches a kick to deliver a knee to the gut and chops, only for Kazuya to respond with a roundhouse kick that knocks Shinya out of the ring. Yamazaki follows out to nail forearms to the back before rolling Hashimoto in to continue the attack with jabs. And they trade slaps and overhead chops that takes Kazuya down when Shinya would go for a sleeper, but they're in the ropes for a break. And Hashimoto continues with several knees to the midsection, followed by a DDT and applying a Fujiwara armbar, before transitioning into a cross armbreaker. But Yamazaki counters it into a leg lock and twisting the ankle, only to release to drop knees across the ribs and lock on another cross armbreaker, which Shinya blocks by keeping his arms connected.
These early shots in the match almost look like a cat fight shoot. They're just like slapping the hell out of each other.
Hashimoto powers his way free, which leads to more knees from him, before going for a vertical suplex, only for Yamazaki to block and counter into an arm lock. Hashimoto chops his way free again, but Kazuya catches one to work the arm once more, forcing Shinya to reach for the ropes with his boot to break the hold. Yamazaki nails multiple kicks to the hurt arm now, and the head of Hashimoto, knocking him down to reapply the arm breaker, only for Shinya to again reach the ropes. Gazua's kicking away on Hashimoto in a corner, with the ref trying to stop him, only to be shoved away at first. But Tiger Itori's finally able to pull Yamazaki out, allowing Shinya to deliver a shoulder tackle that sends everyone crashing down to the mat.
Yeah, I mean, I do love the desperation of it, where it's like, oh, well, this guy is the champion, and this is a big moment for me. I'm not going to lay off. And then pushes the ref out of the way, and that's the moment that Shinya Hashimoto has, without taking kicks to his rib, shoulder, and head, to make his move, and because of it, ref bump, if you will.
Hashimoto makes it to his feet first to nail massive kicks before locking on a cross arm breaker. And when the ref makes it back in to check on Kazuha, he determines that he can't continue for the ref stoppage and the win.
Intelligent, such intelligent storytelling to keep the champion safe and make a guy look like he's giving it his all. Yeah.
Post-match, Yamazaki is not happy about the decision.
Of course not.
Pointing out that he never tapped.
This is horseshit.
I do love also that, like, you know, the young boys, the young lions, are there to... They're tending to Tiger Hattori, the ref, as he is recovering from getting mowed over by the brick shithouse that is Shinya Hashimoto.
So on the videotape we have, at this point we get a worked MMA match between Don Fry and Kazuyuki Fujita, but it's not part of the G1, so we decided not to cover it.
Oh, I watched it.
Yeah. I did not.
But if you ever wondered about what Enokiism is, it's a match to watch.
I would say that it's a better example of Enokiism, like, working to an extent. Because sometimes it's a mess, this feels a little bit better, and Enoki, at the end of the match, comes out, makes a big deal, and there's a big, like, pull-apart thing. It's actually a pretty decent and short watch. Don Fry looks awesome. It's very TA, Magnum TA-esque.
I got that vibe from him when I saw him walking down to the ring.
But moving on.
Yeah. So we go to our seventh match. Buff Bagwell versus Kenzuki Sasaki in a second round battle.
If Bagwell wins, we riot.
And we're now on the second day of the tournament. And both of these gentlemen got buys into the second round. And you ask why? Because Buff's the stuff and Kenzuki's the dream?
Yeah.
Good enough reason for me?
Works for me.
Ex-Power Warrior. I do love Sasaki's look. It's not that much different. But the Fu Manchu with the mullet and the leather jacket really fits him better than the makeup.
And Zaddy pads. Vibes?
Yeah, it's gross. It's really gross. But he looks like a more imposing Chono, like with his, because he's got he's got the Fu Manchu. It's not a full goatee.
Yeah,
he's larger. His mullet looks cooler. He's got better glasses. His leather jacket looks cooler.
He looks real.
Yeah, he looks real. Whereas like
wearing a costume or makeup.
Yeah, and Chono's feels a little bit more costumey.
One of the last times we saw him, I want to say that's what I envisioned.
Him to be, yeah. He looks like a
Shockmaster to dress like was him because he came out with this like Terminator type getup.
Yeah, no, he looks like a think of American biker, but like not the one with the.
But like, if your brother was an American biker,
but he was Japanese. But it's like, he doesn't have like the tattoos and shit. It's like an American biker, like filtered through Japanese culture in a very believable way.
So our two competitors trade shoulder blocks and hip tosses, with Bagwell posing after every move he makes.
Nerd.
But Sasaki nails a lariat to take Buff down, leading to Bagwell slapping Kazuki. But Sasaki fires right back with chops, a back body drop, and a clothesline that sends Buff out to the floor. Kazuki follows out to continue the punishment with more chops, and he goes for a whip, only for it to be reversed, sending Sasaki into a guardrail, putting Bagwell in control. And Kenzuki's back is rammed against the apron before being rolled back in, where Buff stomps away, followed by a suplex attempt, but Sasaki reverses into one of his own.
And if Bagwell could just stop posing between stomps, maybe it wouldn't have been reversed.
But, I mean...
But then how would you know he's the stuff?
Exactly.
He's full of stuff.
You gotta show the stuff so people will know you're the stuff and want your stuff.
Yeah. I don't want any of it.
Kazuki telegraphs a back body drop, so Bagwell kicks him away and goes for several clotheslines, but none do the trick. Only to finally nail a dropkick that knocks Sasaki off his feet. Buff rakes the eyes on the ropes, chokes with his boot before body slamming Kazuki and tossing him out to the floor, where Bagwell delivers a not-so-rubber band slam across the guardrail.
Ah.
And Sasaki's rammed back first against the apron once more before being rolled back in, but fires up with chops, only for Buff to respond with a rake of the eyes and a clothesline. Bagwell then delivers a fisherman suplex for a two count, hits a lariat before nailing the Buff blockbuster for the pin. And no, Kazuki kicks out.
I watched this match. I know the outcome, but my blood started to boil for a second. You're good at your job, man.
Bagwell is then caught with a power slam for a near fall, followed by an Aponze for the pin. And the win.
Sorry about your stuff, Buff.
And that Imponze, which I didn't know what it was called until you just said it, looks like a really like shoot slash rough arm drag.
It's a real judo throw.
Okay, well, it looks like it, because it looks like he just could have pulled his arm out like he was an action figure, which Buff kind of looks like an action figure.
We then go to footage from the matches we have seen so far and an updated bracket as we have reached the end of part one of our video. But part two starts right up with more footage from the matches that have happened so far.
So well done.
We then get a recap of the matches as well with highlights.
All the finishes.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
To let us know who won and an updated bracket once more.
I mean... What a wonderful like 2 VHS tape to purchase at some point in your life, where it's like, oh, so professionally put together.
I just wish I could read the brackets.
Oh yeah.
Like I kept following the little red lines as they went from box to box, trying to think, okay, well,
who was it?
This is this one. Okay, so yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's
we'll
like
see who they throw me a match with next.
Too many matches to keep track of, and I can't read kanji.
So we go to our eighth match, Hiroyoshi Tenzan versus Satoshi Kojima in a second round battle.
Battle of the big, beefy boys.
And Satoshi comes out wearing an NWO shirt.
What?
No.
Which surprises the crowd. But he immediately rips it off and tears it in two. Well,
that's going to come back to haunt you.
It's very funny because he comes out and he like tries to rip it at first, gives up. Closer to, like, he's at ringside and finally, like, tears it off in half. But it's like, man, you should have gimmicked the collar a little bit and scored it from the inside or something. But either way, it's still cool.
And our two competitors charge at each other immediately with lariats, not knocking each other down. Before going into a test of strength. But neither gains an advantage from it. So they start slapping each other. Followed by Mongolian chops and headbutts from Tenzan to take Satoshi down.
And I'd say at this point, this is the hottest match crowd-wise, of course. I mean, we're in round two, and I couldn't tell who got the bigger pop. I feel like maybe it was Kojima, but both men are on the rise in this company, and you can feel it because this match feels big and it feels important. And they're both working like it is. So who am I to disagree?
Hiroyoshi misses a clothesline, allowing Kojima to bounce off the ropes with one of his own, before a standing senton to keep up the tag. Tenzan responds with a takedown and begins working the leg of Satoshi with a single leg crab, and stomps. But Kojima escapes and goes for the leg as well, momentarily, until Hiroyoshi makes the ropes. And Satoshi keeps up the attack with rakes of the eyes, stomps, Mongolian chops, which just fires up Tenzan to hit more Mongo chops of his own.
It's fun also because, yeah, these guys have the signature Mongolian chop. And Kojima, the face here, is not above cheating because he knows this guy is going to cheat So it's like, all right, fight fire with fire.
Hiroyoshi hits a spinning heel kick for a two count, a headbutt to the gut, and a bulldog of Kojima for a near fall, before trying for a suplex, only for Toshi to reverse it into one of his own, followed by corner lariats. And Kojima heads up top for an elbow drop that gets two, before hitting a riding bomb for a near fall, followed by going up top again, only for Tenzan to meet him there for a super Samoan drop.
My God. Is the riding bomb the bulldog?
The sit-out spine buster.
Oh, sit-out spine buster, okay.
Hiroyoshi now heads up top to nail a diving headbutt for a two count, before going into a weak Boston Crab that Satoshi makes the ropes to a break immediately.
Yeah, that Boston Crab was like a Boston Crab filtered through a camel clutch.
Tenzan hits a powerbomb and goes to the top once more.
Big power.
Flying off, but Kojima catches him in midair with a lariat.
Love it.
Satoshi hits a running lariat and tries for another, only for Hiroyoshi to meet him with one also. So Kojima tries for a third, but Tenzan catches him and attempts to lift him up when Satoshi would counter into a Koji cutter for the pin. And the... No! Hiroyoshi kicks out.
Crowd goes
wild. Satoshi goes to the top for a moonsault.
He's fired up.
But Tenzan stops him and throws Kojima with a super back suplex for a near fall. And the two trade headbutts and strikes in the middle of the ring.
I mean, we're on all fours, guys. And this is some of the best all fours headbutt off I've seen. The crowd's chanting for Kojima. It's hot as hell.
When Hiroyoshi would deliver a TTD, Tenzan Tombstone Driver, and a moonsault for the pin and the win. Post-match officials check on Satoshi, bringing out a stretcher to get him to the back.
I mean, maybe I'm showing my hand, but is this the best match so far?
Possibly.
Just on the show, it's so far, I think that it went there for me. The crowd has a lot to do with it. And the fact that this match means something. Stretcher job, cherry on top.
So we go to our ninth match. Scott Norton with Buff Bagwell versus the Great Muda with Hiro Saito in a second round battle.
So instead of NWO for life, it's NWO to fight.
For glory.
For glory.
For glory.
So Muda sticks his hand out for a handshake, with Norton reluctantly taking it, only for Great Muda to spit green mist into his eyes.
Oh, you dummy.
Allowing him to go on the attack with a handspring back elbow. But Scott catches and drops Muda with a German suplex.
Also, Muda had the black and blue makeup in his first match. He's rocking the NWO makeup that Shane loves so much. I mean, I love it too.
I dug this one. Yeah, the first one, the blue one, I thought it was going to have the NWO on there too. But
it's smart for him to save it for the second round against the NWO guy. Who's the real NWO?
I just looked at it as a tribute to the Blue Meanie or our BWO brethren.
Yeah, I'm sure that the Great Muda is well aware of the BWO.
Hey, he knows Paul.
Yeah, I'm sure he does.
Norton rolls out where Bagwell washes the mist out of Scott's eyes with some water, while Great Muda attacks from behind with a soda can and runs Norton into a guardrail, followed by a handspring back elbow and a chair shot. Scott's rolled back in while Muda continues the punishment with a springboard single sledge, a flash elbow drop, and a sleeper that Norton powers out of with a back suplex. Now Scott nails a clothesline, a second rope forearm, and a powerbomb before heading up the turnbuckle, only for Great Muda to meet him there for a super Frankensteiner. And after a reversed whip, Muda ducks a clothesline and an avalanche attack that sends Norton crashing out to the floor. So Great Muda flies over the ropes with a slingshot plancha atop Scott before rolling him back in. And Muda returns to the ring with another top rope single sledge, which Norton retaliates with a clothesline. He tries for another, but but Great Muta ducks and looks to spray the mist again, only to just spit into the air, allowing Scott to nail a lariat and a power slam for the pin and the win.
Crazy. Crazy.
I didn't get this ending. Mm-hmm. It was like Muta was kind of just like laying down for him.
Yeah, he is, and we all know he's kind of a guy that doesn't like to do that. He's not quite at that point of his career yet, maybe, but he probably knows that this is what he has to do, and he probably didn't want to put over as well as he wanted to. But it was a surprising finish for us. But it sounds like, it looks like he, the way that I interpreted the ending was that he spits the mist as a sign of like intimidation towards Scott Norton, and Scott Norton isn't having it and just knocks, lays his ass out and pins him. So it's like, oh, Muta, you think you're so bad or that you can intimidate people, but I'm big and I'm not afraid of you. And because of that, you lost.
So in my head, after I saw Chono come out with the walking boot in the next match, I was like, oh, they probably had to change the winners of certain matches because Chono couldn't have gone. And I thought that was one of the matches that they possibly changed. But I'm like, but Norton, it would have made more sense if Norton faces who was on the other side of the bracket.
Yeah, for sure. But I don't know that Muta's leg, I don't know that Chono's leg, excuse me, is actually injured.
I don't know either. Yeah. I mean, I do know that he doesn't have another singles match until October.
Oh, okay.
So it's a couple months. I mean, he still does like a couple tags, some six-mans.
Yeah, but not a singles
match. But not a singles match.
Yeah.
So I feel like he may have been injured, because back then those guys like literally would have been like, yeah, I'm going to work.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, like, just not yeah. work as hard, basically. Uh-huh,
yeah.
Yep.
And he's also got a perfect excuse for it because he's heel at the moment, so
yeah.
It works. Either way, it works. I interpreted the finish. I can see why you're like, oh, I don't really understand the finish, but I felt like it was a little bit, made a little bit more sense to me, but I was still surprised. A Norton win, but not all of the NWO can go through.
No. So we go to our 10th match, Masahiro Chono with the NWO, like all of them,
mm-hmm.
versus Shinya Hashimoto in a second round battle. And Chono has a walking boot on his foot as he makes his way to the ring.
Did you notice that his walking boot has the NWO logo on it?
Yeah. And Chono attacks as Shinya is being checked on by the ref, stomping away on him until Hashimoto is up to his feet to trade right hands, when Shinya would nail a pair of roundhouse kicks to take down Masahiro.
Yeah.
But he makes it back to his feet to hit a big walking boot to the face. Chono then kicks Hashimoto out to the floor, where the NWO attacks, only for some of New Japan's finest to fight them off to rescue Shinya.
Love it. I love, there's a close-up of Chono's boot, like, as Shinya kicks him down to the mat. It's so good. Good camera work.
Back in the ring, Masahiro locks on the STF, which Hashimoto escapes by making the ropes, forcing a break. But Chono keeps up the attack with a leg drop, headbutts, and right hands. He goes for a suplex, only to be reversed into a brainbuster by Shinya, followed by twisting on the hurt foot for the submission and the win.
Goddamn.
Post-match, Pier 6 breaks out, while Masahiro escapes to the floor, watching on in pain.
I mean, I love this. Fucking Shinya, he works from under, but still exploits the injury at the end for the win. It's so hot. The moment when Chono puts on the STF, the crowd, just like all 11,000 people are making a noise. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Love to see it.
Eric Watts gets a royalty check every time somebody does the STF.
God damn. I hope that he's doing well, but I don't know that he deserves that check.
So we go to our 11th match. Hiroyoshi Tenzan with Hiro Saito and Masahiro Chono versus Shinya Hashimoto in a semi-final match. And we're now on the third day of the tournament, so last day. And we get back and forth action to start with the two trading shoulder blocks, headbutts, and chops until Tenzan nails a spinning heel kick, only for Shinya to respond with stiff kicks in a corner.
Both these big boys are just absorbing each other's punishment.
Several knees by Hashimoto puts Hiroyoshi on the mat, followed by wearing him down with different holds, including a cross arm breaker that forces Tenzan to make the ropes. Shinya continues with throat thrusts, but Hiroyoshi fires back with some Mongolian chops to change the momentum before a body slam and an arm breaker of his own, causing Hashimoto to make the ropes.
I love the Shinya just like no-selling the big hits or whatever, and then Tenzan hits a moderately believable Mongolian chop, and the way Shinya just falls to the mat is like almost... It's like not quite cartoon, but just, yeah, he just falls like a ton of bricks to the mat. It's real cool.
Tenzan with some right hands, spits in Shinya's face, who retaliates with right hands and kicks for a two count, before attempting a suplex, only for Hiroyoshi to block and back him into the ropes, causing the ref to break them up. But as soon as the ref is out of the way,
yes,
Hashimoto kicks and DDTs Tenzan, spiking him on his head.
It's such a great, like, he's like, okay, I'm right back in, right there with the kick and the quick DDT, and such a great sell where Tenzan had to, just, he had to have wanted it, because he goes, yeah, it's a spike DDT.
Followed by a jumping DDT. For the pin.
My God.
And the Hiroyoshi kicks out and rolls to the floor to regroup.
And you know what? To defend how brutal those looked, the man's, one of his finishers, signature moves, is the diving headbutt. And he has a cinder block for a head, if you've ever seen him. It is a giant square. He is the most Samoan Japanese wrestler at this point in time.
Back in the ring, Shinya with a back fist and multiple roundhouse kicks, when Chono would jump on the apron to distract everybody, allowing Tenzan to attack from behind. And Hiroyoshi continues with a running lariat for a two count, a TTD and heads up top for a pair of diving headbutts for a near fall. Tenzan heads upstairs once again, but his foot gets stuck in the padding as he goes to leap off.
Oh my God.
Causing him just to crash to the mat, with both the ref and the members of the NWO trying to help him get loose.
Yeah, watching Chono there, it's like, dude, get out from under the ropes. Pull yourself up.
Yeah. It's pretty funny. And his crash to the mat looks like, is, you could call this like spot goofy, but he sells the fall to the mat because his foot gets caught, but it just looks like he tumbles like the back first onto the...
I don't think it was a planned
spot. See, I was trying to figure
that out. I think it was a botch.
Really? Yeah, but it was a well-sold botch.
It was a well-sold botch.
Because, I mean, the way his boot was upside down on top of the pole or whatever the hell that was there. Yeah, there's... I don't know if that could be planned like that.
That's a good point, but this is a prime example of something I've said plenty of times, that a botch that gets played is serious, and everybody that's there like knows, has the right instinct of what to do, works and often elevates a match. Mm-hmm. It's when you do the spot over again, or you don't have the confidence, intelligence, or foresight to just let, yeah, no, you're simulating a fight. So if something goes wrong or something you didn't plan happened, like the simulation shouldn't stop. And I think I did a pretty good job of it here.
Hashimoto's back to his feet for more chops and kicks for a two count, only for Hiroyoshi to fire back with a clothesline, a body slam, and a diving headbutt for the pin. And the Shinya kicks out.
He can't believe it.
Tenzan delivers one more diving headbutt.
A fourth.
Making the cover for the pin and the win.
We get the big Tenzan chant. So, you know, he's on the rise. He just beat the champion. It's a huge deal. And Shinya obviously looks surprised and disappointed as he leaves to the back. It's kind of probably feeling a little bit of disgrace.
Yeah. So we go to our 12th match. Scott Norton with Buff Bagwell versus Kensuke Sasaki in a semi-final match. And Norton goes right on the attack with knees, an avalanche in a corner, and a shoulder block before nailing a shoulder breaker and an arm breaker DDT. And Scott continues by tossing Kensuke out to the floor to run him shoulder first into a ring post.
Posted.
Followed by returning him to the ring for another shoulder breaker that gets a two count.
Weak cover.
Norton whips Kensuke to the corner, only for him to bounce out with a lariat before nailing multiple more to knock Scott down.
Yeah.
Sasaki then hits a brain buster for a near fall, but a shot to the gut and headbutts allow Scott to deliver a powerbomb for a two count. Kensuke then reverses a whip and hits a power slam for a near fall, followed by an imponze for the pin. And no, Norton kicks out. Scott ducks a clothesline and comes off the ropes, only for Sasaki to nail a back body drop and a Northern Lights bomb. But Norton kicks out at one.
My God. I mean, the moment where he hits the imponze, he gets the two count, but fans thought that he may have just won with that because that imponze move has been put over. And yeah, I am pumped me up because I was like, oh shit. Looked good, felt like it might happen, but the crowd felt the same way as me. And they're much more well-informed, especially at this point in time.
Kensuke with several more lariats before delivering another Northern Lights bomb for the pin and the win.
Another thing to point out, Sasaki, he is selling his arm on his walk to the back. Just to keep in mind, for the next match, he doesn't speak to the camera. He, you know, just looks concerned about the fact that Norton just may have severely injured his arm.
We then go to footage of the wrestlers warming up before anyone's in the building. And we go to the Japanese commentators where Yoshinara Suji, Masa Saito, and Sochi Sabrata preview the final, all in Japanese. So we go to our 13th match. Hiroyoshi Tenzan with the entire NWO versus Kensuke Sasaki in the G1 Climax Final. And the finals was the same night as the semifinals. Like, basically, semifinals were like middle of the card. Finals were the main event.
Hence the elbow injury.
And also the reason Hiroyoshi has a bloody lip to start.
Yes.
And Tenzan goes right after Kensuke with headbutts, Mongolian chops, and the haymakers before a body slam and heading up top for a diving headbutt for a two count. Hiroyoshi keeps up the attack until Sasaki starts firing up with big right hands that forces the ref to back him up as his fists are clenched.
These guys are high energy. Like, their energy is palpable. It's electric. The crowd's electric. I love the energy. It's something that's missing from, I think, wrestling as a whole at this point. It can't be every night, but it's got to happen a couple times a year. And, it's wild that this is from 97, but I'm still feeling it through the VHS rip that I'm watching. Really, really says a lot.
Sasaki continues laying it in, which gets the lip bleeding again, until Tenzan retaliates with more Mongo chops and a lariat for a near fall. Hiroyoshi hits a backdrop suplex, but he can't capitalize as Kensuke is back to his feet first and goes for the Scorpion Deathlock, which brings Chono up on the apron.
Boom.
Only for Yoshida to come over to try to get him down.
Hell yeah.
And Sasaki finally gets the hold locked in, sending Tenzan crawling to the ropes to make the break.
He's too quick to the ropes.
Followed by rolling out to regroup.
Of course he would.
And Hiroyoshi returns, only for Kensuke to drop kick the knee before applying an STF, again making Tenzan crawl to the ropes.
I do love that, like, as soon as he gets back in the ring, he's like, well, I know what to do. I'm going to drop kick your knee.
But
Sasaki with stomps, chops, and a jumping elbow drop for a two count, followed by a lariat for a near fall. Kanzuki calls for the finish, trying to go for the Northern Lights bomb, only for Hiroyoshi to counter into a TTD and head up top for the diving headbutt that gets the pin, and the Sasaki kicks out.
I love the crowd breaks to applause. Yeah, when he comes down with the diving headbutt. They're just like, oh man, this is too good. We don't even know what to do. We're just going to clap.
Hiroyoshi with a body slam and another diving headbutt, making the cover for the pin. And Kanzuki kicks out again. And the two men trade JYD style headbutts.
Love it.
Before haymakers and a Northern Lights bomb by Sasaki.
I'm loving it.
For a one count.
My God.
Kanzuki with a lariat and another Northern Lights bomb for the pin and the win.
My God, hell yes. There's a moment in this match earlier where there's like some Muda cam. They, you know, do a close up of Muda. And I was like curious if it was going to be a tease where he might get nasty and involved in the match. So that added to the energy and anxiety of like what might happen as I was watching it. And I don't know if that was intended or not, but it really got my blood moving.
Post-match, Sasaki celebrates in the ring as the NWO make their way to the back. Kanzuki is then presented several trophies and a big check for 10 million yen.
Two trophies.
Which, with inflation and exchange rate, would be worth $71,000 today.
Oh, wow. I thought the yen was at a low, but I don't know what the yen exchange rate's ever been.
Yeah,
really.
I don't either.
Kanzuki would head to the back to celebrate with beers, lovely ladies, and other wrestlers who end up pouring the beer all over his head.
Yeah, it's very charming and nice.
And he's interviewed, but once again, it's in Japanese, so no clue what's being said. Before we get a highlight package from Tape 2, where a list of credits in Japanese is shown. But I believe they were career highlights of Sasaki because the dates matched up. Because it was like 1960, because numbers don't translate into Japanese, basically. They're still there. So I could tell that, like,
yeah, it's the universal
1966/8.
Yeah.
Guess what? That's when he was born.
Oh.
1985/6, that's when he began training. 1986/2, his debut. So on and so forth. Because basically really cool. It keeps going. 1995-11 was when he won the WCW U.S. Heavyweight Championship. He won. Several of them were when he became tag team champions with Hiroshi Hase, Road Warrior Hawk, and Riki Choshu.
What a wonderful trio of tag team partners.
1997/8/3, which would be that day, he became the G1 champion. 1997/8/10, he teamed with Kazuyo Yamazaki to become the 32nd IWGP Tag Team Champion, so he's now a four-time Tag Team Champion. But then on 1997/8/31, so literally on the course of a month, G1 Champion, Tag Team Champion, on the 31st, he would defeat Shinya Hashimoto to become the 20th IWGP Heavyweight Champion.
That's cool.
Damn.
Yeah, it's also funny because it's like, oh, well, this tape came out like a year after this if they put that on there. Yeah, and I guess we won't cover that match, but I bet it's fun.
If we could find it.
Maybe we'd watch it.
Maybe we'd watch it.
Who knows?
But after that, after those credits, the tape fades to black. And I ask you, gentlemen, what are your overall thoughts of the G1 Climax Final 1997?
I mean, good stuff. You know, we talk about loving a single elimination tournament. We don't see them enough. This is a large one that means something. I would say it means more, or at least it feels like it means more than a King of the Ring, which is kind of our only other regular one that we cover. The crowd is hot. You don't need to speak Japanese to understand the context of most of the guys. You can pick it up through the crowd or how the match looks. We're telling stories in the rings here. It's pretty great. The fact that the final happens the same night as those men won their semifinal, adds more energy to it, and it becomes like a knockdown drag out. I'm leaving it out all on the table, and I can't waste any time. So, yeah. A no bullshit show. It's not a Super Junior show, where Super Junior shows are faster and more fantastical. I don't know which way they're flashier.
No.
Because they're juniors. Yeah, exactly. They're flashier, but in this one there was less mat wrestling than I expected. Everybody, this was all big boy shit, and there was a lot of it. I love that the NWO lost. The NWO was obviously booked differently in New Japan, and they work differently. And yeah, it's like no complaints here, especially because
no creative clauses in those contracts.
No, we've also watched so much more Japanese junior wrestling. It was nice to see some just like big boy slammy around shit. I love some convincing and intelligent, well played mat wrestling, but here there's still limb work and mat stuff, but it's not, these guys are bigger, and when they put on a hold, it's because they've already kicked the shit out of, done a shoulder breaker, whatever. It's like they already started on it before they put that on, and they don't feel like rest spots. These guys are big enough to where it's like, oh, he kicked me in the shoulder. I wouldn't want to be kicked in the shoulder by Shinya Hashimoto at any age of my life or his.
Yep. It was a good show. It was a very long show. I know we always talk about how when we only get a handful of matches, we always want the full show. But when they showed the kind of the recap of what happened on the first day, and it was kind of one of those glass-shattering moments of, we probably could have done without that, but then we would have missed out on a couple of things. But I don't know if I would have fully missed it.
There's a couple of them where it's like, these could have, if like we had to cut them, there's a couple of matches that could have been cut. But for context, I think they add to the whole.
Oh, I mean, I agree.
Of course they add to the whole, but...
But it just...
It was a lot of time.
Once the second round started, then it was like things got a little more exciting, and then it was just on from there. Yeah, those first couple ones, don't get me wrong, I love seeing William Regal over there. Bagwell, I could do without.
I mean, yeah. Bagwell
Norton,
was...
I know he serves a purpose, and you know he fits in with the Japanese wrestlers over there, but he's always been one that just... I don't get excited when I have Scott Norton in the ring.
I'm cool with Japanese Japan Norton, more so than American Norton.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that...
And that's where my bias comes from. Is
yeah.
I mostly know him from WCW, and
I mean,
he's boring as fuck.
Me
WCW.
Too, but here, like, he's respected, the guys respect him, and his near falls mean something. So that was cool to see. And, like, he's so fucking big. This is the biggest we've ever seen him. He's crazy looking.
Yeah, it was a good show, though. I enjoyed it.
I mean, I agree with you, Shane, that this show definitely does start slower than most Japanese shows that we watch. And we probably could have just watched tape two.
But the tape one has good matches.
If we watched tape two, then we probably would have been having the old conversation of...
Man, I wish we would have gotten to watch all of it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
I don't regret watching all of it.
It's always... No, absolutely not. The ramp up at the end is tremendous.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Literally every match just, like, built upon each other. And I think I've said it on this show. Kenzuki Sasaki, I never really got him.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cared for him.
It's like we're always like, he's good, but where something's missing.
But this show finally got me.
Yeah.
He dropped the character, and he was just him.
Yeah, no, he for sure. It's like, oh yeah, this guy looks good. He can do the stuff, but now by the end of this show, you're rooting for him.
Yeah.
And you're happy to see him win. Yeah, it came together here, which is how the G1 can and should be used.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, people like this guy, but has he done it yet? And obviously, he had proved himself to get to that point, because you can't just get... There can't be like, we're just going to let you win the G1 and that be the your arrival. It's like, oh no, you've had to already proved yourself in order for this to happen. And they could have just as easily put it on Tenzon, and it would have been just as believable and exciting, I think.
Good. Where's the smart marks at?
There.
All right, fuck you.
I think it's time we smart it up. So what are some of the best moments of this show?
I love the limb work. I love...
the Rydeen bomb.
Yes, I love...
And the Koji cutter. Like, Kojima's... Yeah. Like, here's the thing. Watching Kojima in these couple matches that we watched him, and having also have watched him in, like, current times.
Yeah.
Yeah, he moves a little bit smoother and quicker in the ring.
He can still go.
But he can still go.
He can. I mean, I think he was recently a
champion in another promotion.
I think he had the GHC. What is that?
All Japan?
Not All Japan. Noah. Yeah, I think he had the Noah champion. Recently, he had, I believe, a pretty good match with CM Punk a year or so ago.
Yes, on Forbidden Door.
Yeah, yeah. It was much better. Like, we love...
I'll be part of Bread Club.
Of the what?
Bread Club.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you guys know this, but...
Bread Club.
He Satoshi loves, Kojima loves bread.
And he, and he posts about it on, like, X Twitter all the time about how much he loves bread.
Dear Oprah, put him in a commercial.
Does Oprah love bread?
She did a commercial where that's how it starts off. You know what I love?
Bread.
Bread.
I know he lost, but Tadao Yoshida impressed me.
Absolutely. I'm totally 110% there with you on that.
Like, I don't know how much more we see of him, and it might have just been, like, because Tenzon impressed me as well.
Absolutely.
Like, Tenzon has, like, we saw him...
I was going to ask, have we seen him?
Yeah, we've seen him a bunch of times.
But he's like, he's...
Basically in like the multi-band matches usually.
Okay.
This is basically all we've seen him.
Like, Kensuke Sasaki at this point is more established on like in New Japan than Tenzon, but Tenzon has been on the come up behind him.
I mean, he's
like a year or so behind him as far as like the like dojo goes or whatever.
Ever since the NWO thing started... Basically, they put him, and Hillman and Chono have been, like, lockstep in, like, just, like...
He's basically Chono's, like, underling at this point, where it's like, oh, this is the guy that I'm, like, grooming for big things. So that's why he means something here. And why him falling to Kensuke Sasaki, who has finally come into his own, means something.
The Kazuhis Yamazaki versus Shinya match on the first night, like, I wanted about 10 more minutes of that match because they were just like
going for it,
going so hard.
Shinya doesn't have a lot of moves, but I will say with the right opponent, he's always compelling because like he can't move quickly, but like he's not a fast guy, but. There's spots where he chooses to do a thing quickly, and it, you know, really means something. It kind of like lays back in the cut and relies on his power and the fact that kicks have more distance than a punch. But Shinya is I wouldn't be mad at anybody for not loving him, but you got to appreciate what he brings to the table because it's at least different. And when it's compelling, it's very compelling.
I'm digging Muda. I haven't got to see this vicious side of Muda before. You know, I grew up with Muda and WCW, so it's...
Yeah. I'd say that this is kind of the most compelling Muda has been, whether he's Muda or Keiji Mudo, since that, like, 88 run, where he's, like, full of energy. And this one, he feels like a wild card.
Yep.
In the same way that... In a different way... But in a similar way that he did back then. So this it was really nice to see the like Pillman energy. Era. This is his Pillman era, for sure. I agree with that completely.
Yeah, it's just... It's fun, because I'm seeing... You know, I've always knew that... I guess I don't know for sure if Asuka was trained by him or if she just idolized him, because she mimics a lot of the same stuff that he does. But
yeah.
I'm starting to see some of the crazy clown side of her in him... Not just because of the makeup, but just a lot of the fast action or fast movements, costumes, everything. It's I dig it.
How about most disappointing?
Hey. Ugh. Hey. Ugh. Hey, I didn't talk about it on this.
I know, I kept waiting for you just to be like, just to throw in random.
It's like, oh, well, you know, he doesn't want to do the thing that he was forced to like listen to.
Yeah, the whoever the guy is on commentary, his constant use of the same two words that was way too much for me.
Buff Bagwell.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the weakest link on the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Most shows.
I think he does a good job of...
He generates heat.
Yes. He does it well here.
Mm-hmm.
But we... At this point, even...
He doesn't have to be in the ring to generate heat.
We know that it ends up being go-away heat more than, like, actual heel heat.
Yeah, it's working in Japan because he's the guy... He's the... It's almost like a... You know how we don't love Raven, but we love Stevie Richards?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's an inverse here where, like, Scott Norton, these guys are like, they're like, oh yeah, Scott Norton means something, and then there's Buff Bagwell. But they're like, yeah, fuck this guy.
Yeah, just wait. Yeah. Just wait for Judy to come along.
Yeah.
Honestly. The finish of the Norton-Muda match, we talked about it earlier, where Muda just kind of stops and spits in the air instead of, and so it like it's like he's almost just basically giving up so Norton can win.
I didn't feel the same way, but I understand what you're saying completely.
I mean, like that's my read on it.
Yeah, my read was a little different. My read was him just like trying to scare him, where it's like oh yeah, you know, fear me, the mist or whatever, and he's like, no, fuck you, I eat punks like you for dinner. But the translation may not have been strong enough for everybody to feel that way.
Yeah.
But I think that's what they were going for, and that's the way that I read it. But hey.
The Tenzan getting his foot stuck in the ropes, like, if it was a planned spot...
Gene, almost
nicely done.
Nicely done. But I just the way that Shinya took forever to get back to his feet...
Yeah.
It felt more like a botch.
It did. But I think that the recovery was pretty decent... And the way that his head hit the mat kind of proves the botch, but it made it actually feel like it meant something. It looked more important than goofy, I guess, is the way to put it. It's like, he fell. But it looked fucking like it hurt, as opposed to like it being like some goofy botch.
No, it didn't look like a goofy botch. It looked more like, it looked like a legitimate, like...
Oh, this guy
something happened.
This guy could have broke his neck.
More than
he just...
Yeah.
Than him just being stupid and like... Yeah.
I'll never get mad at a good recovery, but the finish probably could have been a little bit heightened.
Height.
But I mean, he did that and still pulled out the win.
Yeah.
So, hey.
How about best performer of the night?
I'm going to go probably with Tenzan.
He was kind of a standout.
I don't hate it.
He definitely
did not expect Tenzan to...
Full package here. He's kind of...
make it where he made it.
No.
He's got it all.
I mean, that's also going to be my surprise of the night.
I mean, also, the bleeding from the mouth in the last match and him just like... it's kind of no surprise that... And it should be this way. That the final is the best match... And it's the best match, not because it's the best match technically, but because it means so much. You believe it means that much, and both guys are working like it is the most important moment of their career, because it is.
Which for those two guys it was.
It absolutely is. It's not just another G1 win, and you can believe that either man could have won. There's not like any telegraphed winner, I don't think. Tenzan could have won, and I would have been just as happy, even though he's in the NWO. Despicable.
And see, I think that's what was throwing me off about him. If we've seen him before, all I kept looking at was his NWO gear. And
yeah, I'm a little more familiar.
And the fact that he reminds me of Bull Nakano in a way.
Yeah.
Just with hair down instead of standing up.
I mean, yeah, her head probably isn't a square, but it looks like one with the hair. But Tenzan's head is legitimately a perfect square.
So. Well, I mean, you're saying that's the best match. Is it your favorite match?
If it's not, then I would say it's probably that... Or
Tenzan Kojima?
Yes, is that the first one of the second round?
Yes.
Yes, those are my two favorite matches on the show. Tenzan Kojima, and then Tenzan and Kensuke. As much as we gave flowers to Kensuke Sasaki, I think Tenzan was the best performer of the night, and my other favorite performer of the night might be Satoshi Kojima. And a lot of that has to do with those two matches being like neck and neck for my favorite.
And I'd say my third one would be the Shinya versus Kazuya Yamasaki at the end of the first round.
Yeah, that was good.
Because that match, I wanted another 5 minutes.
And that was a short one, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a short one.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I think it went like 7-8 minutes, but like a lot of it was Yamasaki locking on holds and them having to get to the ropes.
What was Yamazaki, like, the story is that he cannot overpower Shinya Hashimoto, so he has to beat him with holds.
Yeah.
So, like, the trade back and forth, it's like Yamazaki was moving like a fucking spider monkey to try to get these things on. So it was intense and exciting. And it also has that great finish where they push the ref away.
Yep.
Which is incredible.
He doesn't ever tap.
No.
The ref just makes the decision that he can't defend himself, which...
It ups Yamazaki for putting up that kind of, like, fight against a man that has, like, 60 pounds on him and is the champion. And Yamazaki is nowhere near being champion.
Slight foreshadowing to a certain series that comes up here soon after, where a similar ending made by the referee. Up an old... Montreal.
And most surprising?
That Bagwell was on the show.
I'm trying to remember. He was on a Super Junior or a Super J or something like that, wasn't he?
No.
We may have seen him on a Super Show.
He's probably in like the Collision in Korea show or something like that.
I'm just trying to remember. There was one show that I thought he was part of, but...
He may have been on a Japan, like... Tokyo Dome tag match or something.
Maybe.
Yeah. He was still Marcus Alexander Bagwell at the time. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, he definitely wasn't buff then.
No. Yeah, he's buff, but.
Okay, he wasn't the stuff.
No.
Prizing. There's nothing to hate here. I mean, Tadao Yasuda being such a great big man, where I'm like, there's just not very many great big men. And I think that he does it as well as anybody that's ever done it well. In the one match here.
It's not really a surprise, but even in Japan, Steven Regal kicks off the show. As it should be.
I mean, he does a great job, but, you know, he's not in the NWO, so...
No.
Yeah. He went there for the payday and the regality of it.
Because you needed some balance.
Yeah.
Huh, regality. Nice.
And now for a look back even further into the history of wrestling.
The dusty finish.
The Nature Boy, Ric Flair, had unified the WCW International World Heavyweight Championship and the World Heavyweight Championship when the newest addition to WCW in Hulk Hogan would make a challenge at Bash at the Beach on July 17th, 1994. The two men would go back and forth to begin, with Nate bailing to the floor every time the Hulkster seems to get an advantage. Flair would finally get on the offensive after Sensuous Sherry trips up Hogan. The Hulk fires back with a pair of suplexes, goes for the leg drop, only for the Nature Boy to move in time. Hogan continues to hit a big boot, but again Sherry interferes, pulling the ref out of the ring. Now a second ref arrives as Nate is locking on a figure four, only for the Hulkster to reach the ropes. But this allows Sherry to choke him, while the ref is distracted. Hogan's friend Mr. T responds by grabbing her and taking her to the back, but he doesn't notice that she left behind some brass knuckles, allowing Flair to use them, only for Hogan to hulk up, hitting the big boot and the leg drop for the pin to become WCW World Heavyweight Champion for the first time. Hulk Hogan would defend the title over the next year, when the son of his most famous rival would arrive to challenge.
Son.
Yeah.
You know what's funny is that I don't remember this at all. I'm like, I don't remember Mr. T showing back up. Maybe I just blocked this out of my mind.
Oh, you just blocked
it. Because it hurts so bad.
Yeah. I mean, the match itself it went very fast, if I remember right.
Uh-huh.
And
feels bad, man.
Yep. But we had Sherry there. She was great.
Yeah, she's always good.
Next week, SummerSlam 1997.
SummerSlam.
I mean, you know, it's one of the big shows of the year.
Yep. Big four, baby.
Let's do it. I'm always excited for SummerSlam.
Music from this week's show is The Score by Emerson, Lake, and Powell. And Kazuke Sasaki won our main event, so we play his music, Take the Dream by Blue Steeler.
As he did on that evening.
I'm excited to hear this music. Finally, something different.
Ryogoku Kokumi-kan.
If you like this episode or any of our other ones, please go out there and rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast at. Do as Michael says.
5 stars or no stars, this show's worth it.
And if you have any questions, comments, concerns.
We are going to New Jersey. One of them Jersey folks eat, drink. What do they like to do in their free time? You ever been to Jersey? I've never been. I'd like to.
Me neither. Jersey has a... It has a vibe.
Sanitation problem.
But I don't know the vibe because I haven't been there. But there's a lot of working class art and...
Working out folks?
Yeah, maybe.
Party line. I'm just looking at Jersey Shore.
Oh, yeah. I never watched
it. Dudes that just, you know...
Mm-hmm.
They fist bump. Work out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know anything other than Jersey... about Jersey other than...
I think New Jersey is kind of like...
It's right there.
Yeah, it's kind of like Philly, but with a coast.
That's a good way of putting it.
I think that's the vibe. But I don't know the Philly vibe either, because I've never been there either. But, like, based on the things that I pull from each place, I think that New Jersey has a little bit of a chip on its shoulder because it's so close to New York. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest difference. But who knows?
I think it's better than me.
Yeah.
I know that Ted Mosby on How I Met Your Mother hated Jersey.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people do.
Yeah, I'm going to go one day.
Yeah, maybe.
I need to go all the way through the East Coast, up and down. But yeah, if you've ever been to Jersey, what should I eat? What should we drink? What should we have? Give me some ideas. Slide into our DMs. Shoot us a message, something. Let us know.
Yeah, what's Bruce Springsteen's favorite sandwich?
Fuck Bruce Springsteen.
Fuck you.
If you have any of those things, you can email us at WrestlingHistoryHex@gmail.com or find us on X at WrestlingHistoX. That's Wrestling HISTOX. X. We'll talk to you next week.
Laters.